Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. In my continued search for in community, I have really been very curious about something called the Sangha, which is, I believe, a Sanskrit term for community that the Buddhists use, and it's a part of their practice. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to be able to understand this particular concept and the value of community within the Buddhist practice. And of course, the Dalai Lama has brought to us a form of Buddhism that was grown up and developed in Tibet. And the Sangha in the Tibetan Buddhist practice is very clear and very strong. I have with me today a man that I've known for many, many years, Gerald Blomeyer. He was first met him in Berlin, Germany. And through the years, we've done a lot of fun things together, including trying to plan and carry out the first German student gathering. And he has moved on and become very involved in Tibetan Buddhism, and I hope will allow us a little insight, at least from his perspective, about the Sangha, about the practice, and about Reiki. So, Gerald, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Phyllis.
You're very welcome. And so can we start by hearing about your Reiki story? Like, how did you meet Reiki, and when was that, and did you think about it, and so on?
Well, in 1986, there was a world fair in Vancouver. And I went there because some architects had exhibited in a project that I was doing in Berlin at that time, and they invited us over. And so I went there with my family, and we went to a place called Hornby Island, which is 5 hours and 3 ferries away from Vancouver.
Exactly. That is like really out there. That's amazing.
It's an amazing and beautiful place. And so I met a guy called Lloyd House, who was making hand-built houses. And he said, well, this is where my girlfriend lives. She does Reiki, but she doesn't want to meet anybody at the moment. So I had to go there the next year. And I met Margaret Sinclair. And Margaret said, yes, I do Reiki. And I said, well, tell me what Reiki is. And she said, well, it's laying on of hands. And at that moment, it really touched my heart, and I said, I want to learn it, which is a strange reaction, because normally you say, I want to find out what it's all about.
Right.
When she laid me down, I'm a man who really has a head full of concepts and ideas, and I had masses of books. And so, you know, here's a lady, you know, just putting her hands on me and not explaining anything. And for the very first time in my life, I felt all my bones were lying one next to the other. Everything was being relaxed. And I said, this is the most amazing thing, because it's a practice and it doesn't come from a theory. There's no concept that you have to believe in or anything. It's just happening. Mm-hmm. And so I said, my first spontaneous idea to say I have to learn it was totally right. I learned it, and well, that was the next years. And so Reiki has been a part of my life ever since then.
That is an amazing story. So you went on and you took second degree, and then eventually you became a master?
Yes, well, I went back to Germany. Margaret actually didn't have a first degree, wasn't a master when we met at that time. She said, now what I'm showing you is all that you have to feel into it. Uh-huh. And then I went back to Germany. I've forgotten the lady who came, but I did a first degree course here. And then I did a second degree course with Jule, who you know very well.
Right.
And then Margaret came over, and she was a full Reiki master then, and she initiated 3 of us as masters. Mm-hmm. And For me, I think the initiations were really amazing every time, because they opened sort of new energy channels in me. And I don't know, I sort of had so much energy after these initiations, and I was really, 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 really moved. And my little first Reiki group was really my first Reiki community, because we continued to practice together for around about 2 to 3 years. And it was a very, the group got a little bit smaller, so maybe we were about 5 people at the end. But I think the difficult times that I was confronted with in at that time, mm-hmm. were, I could only manage them thanks to them. Well, actually, in 1998, the next thing happened. We had the unification of Germany. And if you remember correctly, you had a date, I think, with Jürgen Kindler, mm-hmm. to initiate him as a Reiki master. Yes. And you chose Berlin. And so we had the first East-West Reiki meeting then.
Yes.
And that was really the beginning, because then when my marriage split up, I decided my wife moved to our house in the countryside. Right on the border to East Germany, or which was then all of a sudden a unified Germany.
Right.
And we said, we're going to put on the first German Reiki meeting with people from the East and people from the West. And we gave it the title Overcoming Borders, which was basically also to heal my relationship to her. And so it worked very, very well.
That's great. I remember that. I remember dancing with Shanti Snedler on the floor, this beautiful room with this wonderful wood floor. It was, yes, a great house. Really,
that was
wonderful.
A great house. And we had a huge bonfire afterwards, and yes, everybody had written down what was what sort of hindrances they saw, mm-hmm. in their lives. Mm-hmm. And we had the ritual of burning these little pieces of wood, I think they were, where we'd written on. And so it was, it was a very memorable, very memorable meeting.
Wonderful meeting, really.
Yeah.
It was great.
And just before that, we met at one of the German Reiki Masters meetings. I know this very well, because I met my second wife, Eva Etta Busch. I met her there, and that just blew my head. Right? this was even more powerful than any Reiki that I'd had up until then, because just holding her hand, I just, said words are irrelevant. This woman is like, opening the universe to me.
Yeah.
And really, we lived together for 15 very, very happy years. And it's been an amazing experience to say that love, really, a love that was not just a personal love that went between us, because, somehow it bubbled over and included other people. It was really, really special.
It was very special. Yeah. And when I first heard that you two were seeing each other, I thought, well, they're very different. Or anyway, my impressions of you, the two of you, were very different. She was very outspoken and very gregarious and really funny and just great. And you seemed to be so serious and very structured and so on. So it just felt like this wonderful match on some level. And I didn't know how long it would last. And then when I saw you together, it just felt like you completed each other somehow. There was this, yeah, wonderful connection that you had. It was great.
Well, and she was a Reiki master. And this was really the fundamental basis of our relationship, uh-huh. right from the beginning to the end. And it was interesting that, the Reiki helped us. We gave each other Reiki sessions all through the time, all through the 15 years. Mm-hmm. But it was in a time when she started coming to Berlin that she ran into certain problems. And the problem she ran into was she had the feeling the city was full of energy halls. And she said, just look at that place there. They're people who their expression changes. They look a little bit grim. I can't imagine anybody smiling in that area. Let's wait and see if we can see anybody smiling. And there were very few. And she said, this is why I really feel pulled down. And she asked Paul and she asked you, what can I do? How can I stop it? And it was not clear, you know, what she really could do. And then we went and visited my parents on Malta, which is south of Italy, a small mm-hmm. island. Mm-hmm. And we met a Tibetan Lama. And of all places, he came from Hamburg, where Eva was living. And so this was quite amazing. So we took refuge, and which we didn't really know all the consequences of at the time.
Right.
And then we went back to Hamburg. She went to Hamburg, I went to Berlin. And we commuted between the two places for 8 years before we got married. But in Hamburg, we really started getting into Buddhism. And with Buddhism, she was able to heal these falling into energy holes. She was able to bring in a certain amount of theory her Reiki practice, so that she had a feeling that Buddhism and Reiki were really wonderfully complementary.
Yes. Wonderful.
So then we continued to do the Buddhist part. And in 1998, we invited the Dalai Lama to come, or the Tibetan Center in Hamburg invited the Dalai Lama to come to Hamburg and to give a big teaching. And Aoife and I were two of the 20 organizers of that meeting.
Wow.
And this was,
there
were about 10,000 people that came to this, and so there was a really different size from anything that we had ever done with Reiki before, and it was it went very well, and it was a different sort of community that we were meeting there. I think the community that you meet with Buddhists is one because you have a similar worldview. The ideology of which you approach the world, the philosophy that you use, the things that you can read up and talk about and discuss are sort of really, they're more explicit than they are with Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why we continued doing the two, because we felt the theory was very good. And we also enjoyed the practice that they had of initiations into certain deities. Now, the deities that they have in Buddhism are very much the idea of specific types of Buddha energy that you can be blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
And when Eva started doing her Reiki sessions with people, she all of a sudden felt that these energies manifested when she was doing the treatment. And so she would repeat the mantra at the same time. So she was really doing a Reiki session and mixing these two energies. Many years after, I met other people who were doing Reiki and Buddhism and who had similar experiences. For me, it was never that dramatic. I never saw any energies that sort of appeared and felt like that. But I felt that, you know, it would be good to repeat this mantra or to think of a specific Buddhist energy in mm-hmm. doing Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to a monastery in Nepal, I heard that the abbot was asking a monk, a Buddhist monk, to do Reiki with people. And so I asked him, why Reiki? You're doing Buddhism. What's the relationship between the two? And he said, well, you know, the people come here with a closed heart. They come from their business lives, and they're totally caught up in all this world of concepts, and they're caught up in the I, me, mine thing, and they have never in their lives thought of helping other people. And so I have found that telling them to do a Reiki course with our monk Namgyal, who comes from Australia, he's an Australian Reiki master, is very, very helpful. It's not that the energies are the same, I, the Lama said, think that the Buddhist energies are far stronger and far more differentiated than the Reiki energy. But the Reiki energy is like putting in a foundation. When you, once you've got the people's hearts open, that's something you can build on.
Interesting. So then what happened? I'm caught up in your story.
Well, Eva and I lived a very happy life until she was diagnosed with cancer 7 years ago, and then she died 1 year after that. And really, the if you talk about Reiki communities and Buddhist communities, this was the most amazing thing for her, was to see how supported she felt by both of them. All her Reiki students started coming and to writing to her. The first operation that she had, I had to make a little book for her of all the emails that were sent to her saying, look, if it's not the time to go now, we need you for a while and you've done so much. And so the feedback, you know, please stay with us. Anyway, that kept her. That was a very important step. And during the illness itself, many, many people sent Reiki. And at the same time, we had Buddhist pujas done for her, which puja is a big ceremony where you have, monks or nuns or something. In this case, and when she was having her emergency operation, it was one of her teachers, who was a very high lama, who did a very special ceremony for her with a lot of monks in South India.
Wow.
And when she came out of the, what would you call it, what do you get when you get when you have an operation? The stuff they put into you.
Oh, anesthetic.
The anesthetic. So when she came out of when she got over the anesthetic, when she sort of woke up, she was glowing. She was in a wonderful place, and she was calling the nurses, "Oh, you're a sweet angel," and she was saying all sorts of things. And she'd only just come out of this anesthetic. And so it was a really strange situation. So I went to the doctors and I said, "Thank you. You've really done a great job." And they said, "Well, that's your wife. We can't do things like that." And so I think this is one of the bases that I can say, I can just give advice to everybody. If you know of somebody who's not well, send them love, send them Reiki, send them whatever energies you have. It has a profound effect. Eva was supported in this whole year by these various energies, and in this way she was able to wind up her life in a manner that you could say she really came to the conclusion that she had a wonderful life, and she was looking forward to a great rebirth, and it was very special. We had a special situation, actually a really extremely special situation, because when she was sent home from hospital, the doctor said that she had 6 days to live, and she lived for 2.5 months. And I stayed with her in her hospital room for 2 weeks, which was really strenuous. But because I'd done that, I was able to look after her.
Uh-huh.
And in this period, many Reiki people, many Buddhists, many lamas that we didn't know turned up to give her a special blessing. And also lamas that did know her turned up to give her a special blessing too. So all this process with being looked after by a normal doctor, by normal people who give her, the nurses that came to look after all sorts of things that had to be looked after, and then she was wired to this, all this, this stuff, the morphium on the one side and the food that was being fed into her on the other. And, so she had all these wires going into her, or tubes, not wires, tubes. And so, it was always in a spirit of, calmness. It was, of course, it involved a lot of pain. But it was a feeling of love all the time. And this is why I think, you know, right up to the end, you got a laughing about this or you got a laughing about that, and, which was really wonderful. So every life comes to an end. But a life where you can say with Buddhist prayers and with a lot of Reiki energy certainly comes to an end in a different manner. Mm. I said the suffering is totally different. The feeling of value, the feeling of you know, sort of winding up everything in a wonderful manner. She went so far that she said, you know, she not only gave away everything that she had, but that she owned. She told, this is going to them, this is going to them. She laid it all down. She also said, I'd like to see the little obituary that will be published in the newspaper afterwards. And the graphic designer just broke down. She said, I'm not going to design anything like that as long as you're alive. And I want you to, and so on and so forth. So it was very sweet, very sweet. It was a wonderful. She was a wonderful woman. In the end, she, we got all our Reiki Buddhists and other friends. So we all went out on a boat, and I had her ashes. And she was a great crystal practitioner too. She was a yes. crystal master, and so she had this great big Arizona crystal that she put in. No, it was Arkansas crystal. A beautiful crystal that she said, that has to be buried with me. I want to be dropped in the sea. I want my energies to spread all over the world. I want all the blessings that I have received to spread all over the world. And so this is the feeling that we sank the urn with. It was a salt urn, so it dissolves and then it goes.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And we were very fortunate because the Dalai Lama's translator in Germany is a friend of ours, or was a friend of hers as well. And he did a prayer to Avalokiteshvara, which is the embodiment of compassion. This is the pure compassion, absolute love, total love. And he prepared a small prayer to do this. And in one moment, the captain on the boat said, look, it's too rough for you to use the microphone light. Let me just turn the boat. And then when we started reciting it, this is 1 minute later, the sea went calm. The one ray of sun came out. It was quite magical. And then the horn, he sounded the horn, the foghorn. And many people then said, well, I want to die like this too. And then we had a party and everybody remembered the wonderful things that Aoife had done and the various parts of her life. She really had two very different parts of her life, the life before me and the life with me. And so, again, I can say thank goodness we had Reiki, and thank goodness we had Buddhism, because for us, they were the ideal combination.
Mm. Well, thank you for your story. That was really beautiful, and it gives me the shivers, because I just see you out on the sea, and I can imagine this happening. So that's great. I like, and I'm just captured by this idea of a salt urn. What a wonderful idea!
This is a German tradition, because
really?
You're not allowed to eat. They say if you put something in the sea, it has to be done in a controlled manner. This is why it has to sink to the bottom, so nothing floats around, nothing, you know, so it's that starts that way. This is German law. But I'd like to jump right back to the beginning when you talked about Sangha.
Yes. Can you tell us about just in the teaching, what that means, and if I was accurate?
Well, of course you're accurate, Phyllis. But really, there are three different types of Sangha.
Okay.
When you take refuge in Buddhism, that means you say you look for help. You entrust yourself.
Right.
You look to help for the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most important one is the Dharma. The Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha, and the Dharma tells you all about the importance of combining compassion, your generosity, all these things, really the love for everything in a maximum unconditional manner. It's combining that with a specific worldview that is called interdependence. So everything has a cause. So everything is interdependent. If you drop a stone, it will make waves in the water. If mm-hmm. you, whatever you do, it has an effect. Whatever you think has an effect. Mm-hmm. And so it's the combination of these two that really is the foundation of the Buddhist teachings. So this is the Dharma, and it was said by the Buddha. So we respect the historical Buddha because he put it in words. And then, of course, we have the Sangha. And the Sangha on this level is a group or all the people who have attained enlightenment. So basically, his enlightened students. Then people said, well, you know, you can't tell really if people are enlightened or not. And in fact, actually, according to your motivation, you're really worth just as much as a saint if you try to practice this. And of course, if you practice it properly, you would put on robes and become a monk or a nun. Mm-hmm. So you have a formal order. Every order is called a Sangha. And then, of course, because people say, well, you know, people don't have to be monks or nuns to practice Dharma. They could be lay people too. And as lay people, well, why don't we have a lay people Sangha as well? Because they run centers and groups, and without their help, you won't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is the other part is, of course, is saying, well, if you look, well, we can't hear the Buddha speak, but this is the role of the teacher in Tibetan Buddhism is, of course, a fundamental one. The teacher is the most important one. And you imagine the Buddha speaking through your teacher as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, the teacher cannot exist alone. He needs people to support him. He needs something to keep going. Therefore, the Sangha that involves all these three levels is really the right definition. And I think that's what you said right at the beginning too.
Maybe, but it's much clearer now. Thank you. So when you talk about enlightened students, what does that mean? What is the word enlightened? Like, well, what is that concept in Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, basically, it says that you can see in your mind, your consciousness is absolutely clear. It's luminous, mm-hmm. but it's not shining the way it is, and you're not seeing the world it is, because it's as though you've put blankets over a lamp.
Yes.
And the more blankets, which are concepts, ideas, judgments, or whatever, the more you've put over the lamp, the less you can see. Maybe it's better with sheets, because, you know, blankets wouldn't let any light through. So you say that it's sheets over a lamp. But when you do your practice, your Buddhist practice, the idea is to do techniques, you know, ways of practicing, training your mind, training your body, to take away each one of these sheets, each one of these layers. And then sooner or later, the light will really shine through. And when it shines through and you understand that you're not separate from everything, but that everything really is interconnected, and really the basis of everything is this extreme form of unconditional love, mm-hmm. that's when you talk about enlightenment. And together with the enlightenment, the people, I don't know because I haven't attained it, I'm sorry, but I am told the people become omniscient. That means they see everything the way it fits together.
Wow.
And therefore, Eva asked a wonderful question to a nun many years ago, and it was, why on earth should I want to become enlightened? I'm quite happy the way I am. And the nun said, well, you know, if you see everything the way it fits together, you can really help because you know what that person really needs at that moment. And she said, okay, I want to be enlightened. And so that was her motivation from that moment on, because the idea of being able to help people in the most efficient way to live their potential, to really grow and to make this place or world a better place, I think that was a wonderful motivation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. That's wonderful. So there are, the lamas, are they all considered to be enlightened?
Well,
or on the path?
I'll quote the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
The Dalai Lama says, before you choose a teacher, be prepared to test the teacher up to 10 years. And you look and see whether he practices what he preaches, because there are many people around that pretend to be enlightened and are really after other people's money or interested in misusing them in the one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have to know the quality of your teacher. Now, 10 years is a long time to test a person. And the reason you do this is because you are really making sure that everything fits together, mm-hmm. because that's the moment that you entrust yourself to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher gives you guidance. And only when the teacher gives you guidance can he guide you on a path that will lead you to the enlightenment. So it's a very close relationship between student and teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't talk to all teachers directly, like the Dalai Lama is right. far too popular. So with the Dalai Lama, he says, you can imagine me in the whatever you like. You can imagine me as a friend, a father, an enemy, or also your teacher. Whatever you want, you can use me for anything. You can project on me. And from my point of view, I met the Dalai Lama the first time 40 years ago in South India. And that from that moment on, I was really so deeply touched by him that I have no problem saying the Dalai Lama is my teacher and I entrust myself to him. And I try to follow his teachings as well as I can. I'm still a normal human being and hooked on all sorts of things, but I do my best. After Ifa's death, you see, I decided... You see, looking after a person so intensely for 2.5 months,
mm-hmm.
And she didn't want to see very many people very closely. So I really only had a maximum of 2 hours a day off where I could go out, do shopping and do things like that.
Right.
Apart from that, I was there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation of looking after a person that you love who's dying is, of course, it sort of says, what is this world really all about? What are all these material things? Why does the supermarket have to offer all these products? It seems so nonsensical. People are wasting their time looking after all these stuff and not really seeing that life is going to come to an end and not really trying to be compassionate, not, sort of share their joy, be generous to everybody with everything that they have. But they're going miserly and they're worried about their pensions and, all these things. And I think this is one of the reasons why a year after her death, I closed my office and said, yeah, I really have to digest all this. And that's when I went to India. So, I'm sorry, I sort of lost a little bit of the track, but, at least it tells you that I've been on the road now for 5 years. And I had to sell my flat because I wasn't able to let it. I couldn't find any tenants. So it's made me more of a monk than I ever expected that I wanted to be. Because now I have a suitcase that weighs 20 kilos, so I can get on any aeroplane.
Right.
Yeah. And that's all I own. And I travel with that. And I live off the money that I got from my flat. We'll see how far it takes me.
Well, that is tremendous. You know, I I had this wonderful interview just a couple of weeks ago with Kuan Yin, who is a Sufi, and she is her teacher is Murchid Sam, who gave the world the Dances of Universal Peace, and they have their own community, of course. And, you know, in the Sufi order, to really drop into the practice, you must become a member of the community. And what that means is that you leave your life and you go to the life of the community. And I feel like this is something that, interestingly enough, was you were guided to do, to sell your flat. I mean, I laughed because, you know, I know Berlin, and I know Berlin even 5 years ago. I mean, there's such a desire for people to move to Berlin that it's hard to believe that you couldn't sell it. But it felt like that was some kind of guidance or something for you, so that you really just surrendered
yeah.
into it. And do you think that's true?
I agree. It's totally right. And I must say, I feel much freer. Before I left the first time, I got rid of all my books. I got rid of all sorts of things. And the antiquarian book dealer came and said, you know, you're behaving as though you're going to die. Which I thought was a very good comment, because it was as though my life had been bogged down with all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally when I had to sell the flat, everything went.
Right.
And that was a process of really freeing myself.
Right.
I redefined myself totally that way. Because, you know, you don't have... you don't think about, is somebody using my flat correctly? Did I leave the water on? Is this bill being paid?
Or, right.
All these thoughts about everything are gone. And so it's been very, very, what would you say? It has made me a lighter person, because I didn't have these worries.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the interview that I just did was this woman who has moved to a community in Oregon, and she has this room that she lives in, and she went from a 3,000 square foot home, you know, full of everything in America, to this room where everything actually is owned by the community. So we had a really good talk about letting go and about surrendering into this place. And I've been having these thoughts myself, and it's kind of scary, because what I realize is that attachment is a very tricky thing. I realized a few days ago when I was talking to Mona that my memories are somehow connected to things. And
it's true.
I don't think that that's actually reality. It's like, if I leave the things, will I actually not remember? And this is the part that is so interesting for me. I think that I need to be able to understand that the memories live inside of me, and the way that I live my life allows those memories to continue, or those relationships to continue and mature, actually, without having the stuff around you to anchor it somehow. And it's just a really interesting thing. So I'm fascinated by by listening to your experience of how
I would say, you know, many people say, there are many teachers that say, get rid of all the knick-knack.
Yes.
Next day, you know, today, if you want to free your mind, first step, take all the knick-knack and give it to an old people's home or somebody else,
right,
who can sell it in a garage sale or something like that. There to make it to money. Put it to use. Make it do something. But get rid of it. How many shirts do you have? How many shoes do you have? How many books do you have? Do you really need them? Do you read these books? What is active in your life and what is a passive weight? And they say, get rid of it. Cut it off. It does, they don't say get rid of everything. They just say get rid of everything that you don't use. If you have boxes in your attic that you haven't opened for a year, this was a good old rule that I heard many years ago, get rid of it. You don't need it. You'll never look into it again. And I think everything that you have in your body and your mind that has been meaningful for you, you will always have. I don't think you lose these things. I think we have stored all this information in ourselves, so we don't need anything on the outside, really. Uh-huh. And I must say, I admire your Sufi lady that she lives in a small room owned by the community. I must say, if you ask me what I would like to do, I would do the same thing.
Well, but you have been doing the same thing, is that true?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about community in the Buddhist, community of Buddhists that I deal with. The Reiki community is a very different community because the meetings that I organized for Reiki people were basically, you know, they came together for one specific thing. As Jürgen said in his interview, the people that seem to come more often to these meetings are people who really want to do more in Reiki. Other people are not really interested in taking Reiki deeper.
Right.
But in Buddhism, because you have a theory, you meet your people and you want to discuss your experiences with them. Maybe that's similar to Reiki. But then you see, you have the teachings, you have books and scriptures, you have commentaries. So when you want help about doing a retreat in a specific way, you get a lot of information very quickly.
Yes.
But you also experience the Buddhist community as a lot of individuals.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is the way I experience it. There are organizations, very large organizations, like the Federation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, FPMT. And the FPMT has hundreds of centers all over the world, many in America, Australia, England, Germany, everywhere. And they have a specific publishing house and where you can get your prayers, you can get your traditions. They have all sorts of websites that you can get authentic teachings from, so that you're continuing along your path in a very supported manner. So even if you're an individualist, you have these wonderful organizations. And that the people who work for these organizations, I must say, they will give you a different definition of a Buddhist community than I would, because, of course, they are a part of an organization that really is working for many people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm sort of floating around in a much freer manner. I'm not saying it's better, I'm just saying it's different.
Yes, I understand. So when you go back to India, you live, you have a little place there, or you are there dormitories that people stay in, or I'm just curious about that.
Well, when I first thought I was going to India, I thought I'll rent a flat and then I'll, you know, sort of have a flat there and a flat there. And, you know, so
yeah.
But that's not the way it worked.
Okay.
I rented a flat and the first thing was they said, oh, you know, there's a very good teacher giving this course down there. You should go there. It's really fantastic. So I went there. And so I was going away from my flat. And then 4 years ago, I was asked to help at a school in Sarnath, near Varanasi, founded by an Italian called the Alice Project, which is for very poor children from the countryside. It was originally started for the untouchable children who lived in those districts because there was no school that they could go to.
Right.
And it's been running for 18 years. And the past 4 years, I've helped Valentino to do a certain amount there. Now, I can't stay there all year round. He's amazing because he can stay there all year round. But when you have monsoon and it's so humid, and then they have, I don't know, 45 degrees Celsius temperatures, which is really like living in a sauna.
Right.
It's just too much. It just wipes me out. Valentino puts up with it. And Valentino is a very dedicated Buddhist practitioner, who said, he went to the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama said, you should do education. And so he said, right, I will do this with the motivation. I would like to give back to India all the things that I have profited from them. And so his school not only teaches the normal curriculum, but it also teaches meditation, Sanskrit, and an hour of yoga for every child every day.
Wow.
Of course, when it's extremely hot, the children don't do asanas. They don't do the body movements. They do some part of the yoga theory.
Right.
So this school is quite astounding because the children learn at a very early age to look at a thing called where do your thoughts come from?
Mm.
You see, the school has the name Alice Project because Alice was a girl who went into an inner world. This is a dream that she had because at the end, Lewis Carroll says she wakes up. So if she woke up, it's all in her mind. All these fantastic things she went through are in her mind. So we obviously have an inner world, and we have to find out more about the inner world. And we also have an outer world that we have to know about.
Mm-hmm.
So one is the curriculum that is given to the school that they have to look after, which is very good. This is the physics. And the other is the complement that you need to look after the inner world, which is the metaphysics.
Right.
And so our children, basically, they're a total of around about 800 children who are learning in three schools that we run, and or Valentino runs. I mustn't say I don't run them; he runs them. And these 800 children, they all learn how to learn quickly because really meditation. If you look at mind, what would you say? Memory techniques. How do you train your memory?
Yes.
You will find they're very related to many types of meditation. And so our children really are quite quick to grasp these things. And they, as they come from very poor rural families, they don't have any money in the background. So most of them are not going to be employed in any jobs. And therefore, this is one of Valentino's important thoughts. It is so important that people have a perspective that is not just geared to the economy of our society.
Right.
Otherwise, these children will all be unhappy and dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want, or if anybody hears this, I can just suggest check aliceproject.org, and then you'll find out more about the school. And really, the interesting thing for me was, because I was trained, I used to work in public relations for large real estate developments, to see how Valentino does public relations. He doesn't do it in a normal way. He doesn't do it all the methods that you can think of. He doesn't do it that way because he lives his personality. And he does it with Buddhist prayer. And with a very devout way of dealing with the children. It's an interfaith school. So the children learn prayers from 10 different religions. And they know their Hindu religion very well. So the Gayatri mantra is a very important mantra. It's one that they sing every day. And we also do that. And Valentino recently started a project to recite that 24 hours a day. And at the same time, he's doing a Buddhist prayer with the Tara, the goddess Tara. They're
mm-hmm.
reciting, they have a little Tara temple, and there are 15 nuns from the Kopan Monastery in Nepal, because he gave it to them as a present. So they're reciting that together with the students. So we have, on one campus, we have two places that are reciting prayers 24 hours a day, because we feel, or Valentino's vision was, this is the only way to start changing the world. If you believe that everything that you do has an effect on the world, then start early. Train the children to do something for themselves, for their environment, and for the world.
Fantastic. That's so inspiring. Thank you very much, Gerald. It's time to end. Our hour is almost finished. So that's just so touching and so exciting at the same time that, I feel like I don't watch news or read newspapers very often because I know all these things are going on out there, but then I don't know, there's not this balance of inspired thinking and uninspired thinking. It's just the other, it's just one viewpoint of the world. And it's so nice and so refreshing and so nourishing to know that Valentino has this wonderful vision and that you're participating in it, and that there's a community of people in the Tibetan Buddhist religion that are well, it's not really, I wouldn't say it's a religion, but the Tibetan Buddhism that holds the earth with interdependence. Because I feel that, you know, here in America, we have really lost this concept. And unfortunately, we can see the interdependence in what I would call a negative way rather than a positive way.
And well, this is the challenge. This is the challenge for all of us. I think if we say generosity is more fun, then that's a good way to start.
Great. Generosity is more fun. I like that line. I'm going to write that down.
Actually, it's from Bob Thurman, who's a Buddhist professor in New York. I liked it too. Phyllis, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much. And I hope we will meet again very soon.
Oh, and me too. And I just want you to know that anytime that you have a bit of time and you would love to come see Arizona, you're totally welcome to visit me.
Thank you. I will gladly do that.
Great. So this is Phyllis Rimoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.